Good morning, everyone. My name is Reto Meyer, and I'm the tech lead for the Android Developer Relations team. Today, I'm going to be presenting the third part of my Android Pro Tips trilogy, Android Pro Tips 3, Making Apps Work Like Magic. As always, there will be code. So if you came to Google I.O. just for the Android handouts, now will probably be a good time to sit back and start mentally composing your angry blog post. So I'm old, but I don't particularly look it. It's because in the world of technology, we don't measure age by the simple passing of years, but instead by the number of transistors we can fit on an integrated circuit. Let's call this Moore's age. So Moore's age is exponential. In fact, as we all know, it doubles every 2 years. So let's have a look at this on a logarithmic scale. And here it's much easier to see that my real age is closer to 131,000 years old. That's a lot of time, and it's kind of hard to understand exactly how old that is. Measuring time exponentially isn't something most of us do. So let's have a look at a couple of examples to put that into perspective. It's old enough that I will forever associate going online with this sound. Memories. In fact, it's old enough that growing up, my dad used to sell and service these office machines. Now, back then, IBM compatible meant these golf ball print heads, which would fit into an IBM Selectric 2 typewriter. Now, of course, time, when measured exponentially, moves very, very quickly. So by the time I was in high school, typewriters had all but disappeared, and mobile phones had started to make their first appearances. Now, they were still pretty primitive at that point. You couldn't even send and receive text messages, let alone do any of the amazing things we do with today's smartphones. So it's fair to say that the only people walking around with real personal communicators, let alone tablet computers, were all serving aboard the USS Enterprise. So what does that have to do with building magic apps? Well, we need to put this into perspective. We need to understand what we're trying to achieve. And so handily, one of my favorite science fiction authors, Arthur C. Clarke, has helped define that for us. He said that any significantly advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So that's what we're trying to aim for, but there's a problem because, well, we're all engineers, so we don't really believe in magic. I mean, even back as a teen in the mid-90s, messing around with BNC Terminators trying to get Doom 2 to play on my local area network, I didn't think that the communicator badges in Star Trek were magic. I just thought they were kind of implausible and, you know, poorly thought through. I mean, did you have to press them to initiate a call? How did it know who Riker was and how to get in touch with him? How did it know whether to make the badge tingle or to have the ship's voice tell me that there was an incoming call? They just seemed to magically know how it worked, which didn't seem very realistic to me. Well, here's the thing. 20 years later, we have the science fiction that they depicted for 300 years in the future in all of our pockets. We have personal communicators. We have tablets. It turns out this whole idea of predicting the future to build magical apps based on what's out there is really hard. I discovered this for myself. I mean, 5 years ago, there was no Android. And 3 years ago, I wrote this blog post suggesting that it would probably take about 10 years until we started seeing augmented reality glasses and the sort of voice and gesture recognition that you would need to power them. Now, I look into the audience and I see some glass explorers already, which tells me I was a little off. So even 10 years ahead, I was hopelessly pessimistic. It only took 3 and we got most of the way there. So that represents a real challenge for us. How do we build apps significantly advanced enough to appear magical when it takes 20 years for 300 years worth of technology to come true, when you can't even look 10 years ahead and guess what may be unrealistic? Well, Arthur C. Clarke helps us out again. He tells us to build something to make something seem magic, you need to go past the improbable. You need to look beyond the simple case of, well, what if we can make this smaller? What if we can make this faster? And as Larry was saying in yesterday's keynote, develop things that don't exist yet. Develop things which people don't think are even possible. Now, you'll know that you've been successful if you show the app that you've built to an engineer and they say, is that actually doing anything? Or is that just a mock? That's our aim. That's our goal. That's what we should be trying to achieve. So how do we do such a thing? Well, we know that developing any kind of software is all about compromise. Something which looks great on a design doc, on a whiteboard, often looks more than a little different once we've actually implemented it. So what we need to do is figure out which of those compromises do we need to do in order to ship something, and which of these compromises is going to make our app that little bit less magical. Now, the easy way is to look at your competitors, see what's already out there, find out what features they've got, what platform features they're utilizing, what countries they're localized for, what devices they've built an optimal experience for, and use that as a guide. I mean, you're building this app, so it's obviously going to be better, but you can use your competitors as an idea of where you should be aiming for. Now, the problem with that is that there's a term for this in sports. It's called skating to where the puck was. And it assumes that while you're busily building your app, your competitors are standing still. And that's far from the truth, because they're not even moving at the same speed they were beforehand. The end of last year, we asked you guys in our first Android developer survey, what are your plans for investment in Android over the next 6 months? And more than half of you told us you were planning to increase your investment, and a significant number said to increase it by a lot. So that means, well, of course, the follow-on question to that is, what are you planning to invest in? We asked that too, and you told us you're going to build new apps, you're going to make your existing apps higher quality, and you're going to build new features. So suddenly, in the 6 months that you were building your first version using your competitors as a target, you have more competitors who have better quality apps with more features. So in that 6 months, if you're very lucky, you're just going to be 6 months behind, and chances are you're going to be a lot further behind. Now, you're here trying to learn how to build magic apps. So aiming for the past, aiming for where your competitors already have been, isn't interesting. That's not how you create magic. That's not how you inspire love from your users who have never seen anything like this before, which is why it's so frustrating to see so many developers looking at these graphs as though they have some sort of magic key to the future. These conveniently hockey-shaped pucks represent exactly that, the past. This is the entire ecosystem. So you understand that of the 900 million devices that have been activated, those which are still being used, what that breakup is, and this is still useful to understand your backwards compatibility story, but in terms of your future development, what you're building for, they don't tell the whole story. Because if you're sitting around waiting for Jelly Bean to hit 50% before you start using those features, or if you're waiting for large and extra-large devices to represent 50% of the market, well, you're going to be behind because your competitors are already building those apps. So your chances of having something advanced enough to appear magical return to zero because you already have apps out there taking advantage of these new features. Because if you focus too much on those little slices, it's really easy to forget that the pie keeps getting bigger. 900 million devices, millions of new devices activated each day. And of course, that Jelly Bean slice and those tablet-sized slices represent a much larger proportion of the new activations every day. So we're still talking about hundreds of thousands of users with the latest devices and the latest platforms. And I say this because I want to encourage you all to create the best possible app for every user, especially those on the latest devices, because they are your target audience. They're the ones which have just spent hundreds of dollars on a brand new phone, running the latest version of Android. They're looking to have a magical experience, something which they can use internally to justify this new purchase, something they can show off to their friends and say, hey, check this out, isn't this incredible? I didn't even think that this could be done. So let's start by having a look at some of the simple things you can do to create a magical experience using the latest platform versions. And I think one of the most obvious for me is Android Bean, mainly because it's so simple. Most of this is boilerplate code. All we're saying in OnResume is that if this activity is in the foreground, we want to create a message which we can send across Android Bean. And if we look at create message, again, it's fairly straightforward. The main thing that's happening here is we're creating a payload that's contextualized by the app's current location. So whatever we're doing, reading a book, watching a movie, playing a game, we want to encapsulate this into a payload which we can send to another device. So it can be a URI, it can be a series of integers, it's a byte array, so it can be pretty much anything you like. And then on the receiver end, it's, again, pretty straightforward. You add an intent filter to your activity, saying, I'm interested in receiving Android Bean messages so that I can process them. And then within your activity, you're extracting that payload, figuring out what the context is, and navigating your app to the right location so that you can then have that experience of being able to send something from one device to another by a simple lift tap. Now, I mentioned some examples. You can transfer a news article if you're in a news app, or you can transfer a Maps location in Maps or a restaurant review, or maybe a radio station, or maybe you're playing a game and you'd like to play it multiplayer. So suddenly you can just hold the two devices together, tap them, and you've transferred straight away into a multiplayer experience. Now, that's pretty magical. It may seem old hat to us, but we all have new devices. We all understand this technology, but for regular people, this is the sort of stuff that creates magical experiences. Once you've initiated a multiplayer game that way, everything else seems kludgy. Another example, even easier this time, lock screen widgets. Is there a more valuable piece of screen real estate on a device than the lock screen? Every device with a lock, hopefully most of them, is going to have your widget every time they take their phone off standby. And because not everyone has done this yet, you have that much better chance of being the widget that they select for their phone. And it's a line of XML to say, you know, I've tried it out, it does work on the lock screen, it's worth doing. You've already spent the time building the home screen widget. This just lets your users take advantage of it in a new place. And because it's so valuable, it's worth writing a couple of extra lines of code so that you can specify a different layout specifically for the lock screen. Because if you're the first there, that's great, but you want to make sure that you're kept there. So you want to make sure that that experience on the lock screen is as authentic and native as it can feel, so that a user just sort of starts to think of it as part of their phone, not something that they could ever replace with anyone else's lock screen widget. So it's a great example of where being first isn't necessarily everything, but it's definitely something. It does give you an advantage. So that's a couple of really straightforward things, but there's more to this idea of making magical apps than just using the latest platform versions. And as usual, I have separated my presentation into three distinct sections each with a short animation to give you a little bit of an idea as to what I'm going to talk about, starting with this one. So context. It turns out context isn't just important, it's absolutely critical. And to really get an understanding of how important context is and how useful it can be when developing our apps and the opportunity that it represents for us as developers, I would like you guys to help me out. So I'd like to start by asking you each to take your phones out of your pockets. I'm going to assume you all put them away. And unlock it. Thank you. All right, now... Hand it over to the person sitting next to you. No, don't do that. It's a very bad idea. I would never give any of you my unlocked phone. I'd rather put my home address up on the screen and my vacation schedule than give any of you my unlocked phone. And it's nothing personal. It's not about you guys. I wouldn't give my phone unlocked to friends and family. Now, a bunch of you are sitting next to someone who did manage to score a free phone at Google I.O. this year. Yeah, wait for that to drop. The rest of you know exactly why you would never give your unlocked phone to anyone else. It's because your phone knows you. It knows the news you read. It knows the books you read. It knows the music you listen to, the movies you watch. It knows the games you play. It knows who your friends are. It knows where you live and what your vacation schedule is. All of that information is encapsulated within someone's phone. And that gives us as developers a huge opportunity to be able to leverage some of that context to create these magical experiences, where we can transition from building apps which people use on their phone because it's convenient, to building apps which are personalized for every person who uses it. And that gives you that tie-in, that creates that magic which makes people want to keep using your phone. So what kind of context can we utilize? Well, I think probably the most fundamental piece of context on any mobile device is location. And you all know I like to talk about location. I talked about location a lot back in 2011 here at I.O., and I followed that up with a deep dive into location blog post, and then, of course, there was a sample project, which, you know, contained a couple of dozen classes, just small snippets of code, which were backwards compatible, and, I mean, they weren't too complex. I mean, there was a lot of it. Well, the location team, they had a look at this, and they said, you know, I think we can do better than this. In fact, I think we can make it both more efficient and easier to use, which is why it's so fantastic that here at Google I.O. this year, they've released a new location-based services as part of Google Play services. And it's actually really easy to use. Like most Google Play services, you simply create the new client, call Connect so that your application can bind to this location service, and then you can start using those updates in much the same way as that you would have in the past. And if you look at that implementation, it actually looks pretty naive. This is the sort of code snippet you would have seen in previous years around location, where we just assume that everything works. You don't need to worry about whether providers are enabled or not. And we can't fit more than this on one slide anyway. But the beauty of the Fuse location provider is that that's actually true. It does all of this for you. So all of that having to worry about whether a particular provider is enabled, which provider is giving you the best results at the current time, because maybe it's GPS, but then if I'm inside, it's probably Wi-Fi. Fuse location provider does all of that work for you. You don't have to have receivers looking to find out whether a different provider is enabled. You don't even need to specify a provider or even criteria for us to figure out a provider for you. You just say, I want to get updates within this time frame. And importantly, you tell us what's more important within the context of your application. Do you want to make sure you get as accurate results as possible? Or do you want to make sure the battery lasts as long as possible? Or do you just want to trust us and the Fuse location provider to figure that out for you? It's as simple as that. And then the Fuse location provider does all of that work. And because it's part of Google Play services, as we improve and iterate on those algorithms, we will continue to be able to improve the efficiency of your apps which use this code. So you don't have to worry about any of this. It'll just magically get better and better. All you need to do is tell us what the priority is from your app. So I kind of think of this as working the way it kind of always should have worked. Speaking of which, we now have geofencing, which replaces the much maligned and rightfully so proximity alerts, which didn't work. Geofencing does what they always should have. You specify a particular location, a boundary around that location, and then you tell us whether you're interested in someone coming in or going out of that boundary. And then we send you a pending intent to tell you whenever that happens. So suddenly you're able to use location context without having to follow the user around all the time. Again, built on top of the Fuse location provider. So we do all of that work. We know all the geofences set by all of the apps. And we're able to intelligently select whether we should use GPS or you should use Wi-Fi or some combination or something else entirely based on the proximity from those boundaries. So it's better for efficiency, makes your app simpler. It's better for privacy because you're not having to follow users around. You can still utilize all of that context based on specific locations, but focus them on just the areas that you care about. It's about using context, but in a slightly different way. It's about using the context of your app to know when it's important that you know where someone is. They've also added another API, which was, again, talked about in the keynote yesterday, activity recognition. I think this is really exciting because it represents something totally new. And it's an opportunity for us to be able to know not just where someone is, but what they're doing, what activity they're engaged in, if they're standing still, if they're cycling, if they're driving. And we can suddenly build apps which either use that information directly, so a sports or a fitness app which can keep track of when you're walking, when you're running, when you're cycling, or we can use it to make our existing apps a little bit cleverer. So in this example, we're looking at the results, and we're saying, okay, this app is looking for points of interest based on my current location. So if I'm standing still, I can probably disable all of those updates. I mean, the buildings aren't moving, I'm not moving, so the updates are probably fine as they are. But if I'm driving, or better still, if I'm a passenger in a car where someone else is driving, I may want to get much faster updates so that I can recommend where we should go and eat. So you basically want to crank everything up to 11, make it as fast as possible. Now, we could sort of imply a bunch of this and add it into the Fuse location provider ourselves, but it's actually very contextually based, because in this example, which is almost identical, but here it's an app which is telling us up-to-date sports scores. Now, suddenly, if I'm standing still, I want to get frequent updates because I'm standing there looking at the current sports game. But if I'm cycling, phone's in my pocket, we can probably disable them completely. So it's really about figuring out how your app works, figuring out that context, and being able to use the results we have here based on what the users are actually doing to try and create something more efficient, more magical, just a better app. And really, that's what this comes down to. It's trying to figure out how to utilize this additional contextual information either to create a new user experience or just to make your apps that much more efficient. So we're talking Google Play services. We're talking about context. It would be remiss of me not to at least mention Google Plus. Now, here we have a bunch of opportunities. First and foremost, we have login. So you're able to get rid of all of that username, password, jumping around, having someone create a new account for your service, and then 2 years later when they get a new phone, they can't even remember having created in the first place, can't remember the username or the password, having to start it all again. Here we have the opportunity to take advantage of the fact that most Android users are going to have Google Plus installed on their device, and they're going to be signed into it. So you have that context. You already know this. And with cross-device single sign-on, you only need to do this once. So they click sign in, given the option to accept, and that's it. Suddenly they're logged into your app on every device that they own and always will be. And that's a tremendous opportunity. It's something which feels magical because the user knows that it's their device. They're not going to give it to anyone. So being able to say, well, you already know who I am and that I'm logged in, makes it that much easier, makes it that much more seamless. And once you've logged in, you actually have even more opportunity. Suddenly you know what the person looks like and you know their name, so you can start addressing them personally. You can start using the avatar that they've selected to represent them. And you also get to know who their friends are. Now this is a tremendous opportunity because suddenly you're able to contextualize the content that you're sharing within the application based on what their friends are doing. So restaurants that their friends are eating at, books that they're reading, music that they're listening to, games that they're playing. You can even go a step further and say, well, if all of your friends are reading a particular news article, maybe you should be alerted. Maybe that's a trigger to create a notification. Or maybe you don't want to have so much editorial modification based on this kind of context within your app. So you use it the other way. You use it to create a more efficient app. You say, well, we're not going to suggest that they read it, but we know there's a very good chance that they will anyway. So we're going to prefetch the articles which most of their friends have read, so that we're that much more efficient. Now, there is a risk when we start building all of this context into our applications. And that risk is that we're going to fall into the uncanny app valley. Now, generally speaking, the more context you add to your app, the more awesome it is, right? So what happens here? Well, this is the point of inflection where if you're not careful, your app can go from being intuitive and clever and knowing more than you even thought it could, into being creepy and stalkerish and a little uncomfortable. You want to make sure you're creating experiences where people are thinking, wow, I did not know you could do that, rather than, wow, I did not know you could do that. It's a subtle distinction, but it's important, and it's all about making sure your users are only ever pleasantly surprised. They're never unpleasantly surprised. And that means you need to let them know what you're doing, why you're doing it, and where appropriate, let them opt out of it. Now, I'm not saying you need to nag a user every time you want to use another piece of context. That's not appropriate either. But it should be obvious from everything that your app does and says about itself, starting with the description in Google Play. So something like Google Now, for example, it uses every piece of context it can find to try and create these magical experiences. And it's wonderful, and we love it. But we knew that going in. From the description in Google Play to the first time we open the app, it makes it very clear what's happening. Now, as a counterexample, if you downloaded a replacement keyboard and it started popping up notifications telling you about sporting teams you liked because you searched for them, you'd be a little creeped out. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad idea. I'm just saying that if you do build such a keyboard, you need to make sure that your users understand exactly what's happening with their data, and that's particularly important when you're using anything potentially sensitive. So location information, contact information, all of that, they are all protected behind permissions. So that gives you a really good start. But it's important that you're using that information which users have granted you access to use in a responsible way. So you're not transmitting their location information unless that's something which is fundamental to the way your app works. And if it is, say you have an app which will tell you where you've left your phone, you should only be keeping as much data as you need, the last couple of places, not the last 6 months. And if they uninstall the app, everything should get deleted. Everything on the device, everything on your servers. Uninstalling is basically their way of opting out. And so you need to remove all of that data. And the same goes for things like contacts. It's not uncommon for apps to want to be able to look at your contact list and see whether other people using the same services are their friends. But you never need to actually transmit any of that contact information. You can just hash it. You're not actually trying to email anyone. You're just looking for collisions. And that's a perfect example of where you should be obfuscating that data, making it useful for what you're doing, but not useful for anything else. So if we're trying to make sure that we create no experiences which people find disconcerting, we want to go the other way. We want to create magical experiences which delight people, which segues neatly into my next video. Thank you. So we want to delight users. We want to create experiences that are memorable for the right reasons. Because if we do this right, we can create experiences which move beyond people just using your app and being happy about it, but loving your app and wanting to use it specifically so they can experience the joy of using your app. And this is important. In fact, Rob Foster of Mysterious Trousers recently wrote that introducing visceral elements into an app will make it speak to the subconscious. And that's a concept that really resonated with me, because life is about more than just the things we do. It's about the experiences we have. When we sit down for a meal, it's not just about consuming calories and taking in nutrients. It's about that experience, the smell of the food cooking, the texture of the food, the smell, the taste. Everything about it is something which adds up to much, much more than just the simple process of eating. It's why we eat even when we don't have to. It's why we spend a lot of money to go to nice restaurants, to have that experience. And that's the sort of thing we want to be creating in our app, something visceral, something emotional, which makes people want to use your app, whether they have to or not. I mean, we've all sat around, we're all developers, we've all wondered, why is it that someone is willing to spend $5 multiple times a day on a cup of flavored hot water, but while they're sitting in Starbucks drive-thru waiting for it to arrive, they'll go on their phone and they'll write an angry all-caps screed calling you a thief and a liar because you charge $1.49 for your app instead of 99 cents. And part of the reason for that is a cup of coffee gives you a lot of things for free, which are much, much harder to build into an app. It's the warmth of the mug, the smell of freshly brewed coffee, the first taste of coffee in the morning. It's very hard to emulate those things within an app, but it's that which gives you the value. That's what people are paying for, not just the cup of water, but for the experience around it. Now, that represents a real challenge for us, because if that's what we're trying to achieve, how do we do that? I mean, there are companies like Centair which actually create aromas and aroma delivery systems so that they can make the street out the front of your ice cream shop smell like freshly baked sugar cones, or like freshly brewed coffee, whether they have any of this stuff in the store or not. You can even have the scent of shattered reality, which is, I think, lavender. But until Google Nose has a public API, we're going to need to be a little bit more creative. So we have five senses. And I think we can clearly say that taste is out. Smell, for now, is probably out as well. See what happens next year. So we can focus on the senses that we have. So that means focusing sharply on sight, sound, and of course, everyone's favorite, touch. So how do we do this? And what are we really trying to achieve? Now, because we only have the three senses to work with, we have to work doubly hard to try and generate that emotional response by utilizing the senses that we have available. And that means taking risks. Because if we can do this, if we can make users feel an emotional attachment to our app in the same way that they do their first cup of coffee in the morning, then you don't just have passionate users. You have Kool-Aid drinking fanboys and fangirls. You have people which will go to the forums. They will blog about it. They will talk about your app as the best thing in the world, as a reason to buy a particular phone, just so other people can have this incredible experience. So this may be a little controversial, but I'm going to suggest that you need to break the rules. Now, playing it safe is not the way you make people fall in love. But before you break the rules, like any great artist, you need to understand them fully. It's only by understanding the rules, understanding the philosophy behind it, the spirit, the vision that created them, that you can move beyond them. Now, the good news is that all of that vision and spirit is encapsulated very neatly at developer.android.com/design. And that's where the Android team talk about not just the practicalities, not just how things should look, how things should behave, but the vision that underlies all of that thinking. And that's your baseline. That's where you should be looking to say, well, I want to create my own magical experience. And I mean, I could spend the rest of this session telling you how to create a killer UI element, something which your users will fall in love with and associate just with your app. But then all of you would have that UI element. It would be a lot less useful. So you need to do that hard work yourselves, and I can get away with just explaining more of the rules. Now, I'm not a designer, so I'm not going to go through all of the visual design elements and the right ways to do all of those things. We have a team of designers which have come to Moscone this week to tell you all about it. And all day today, starting in room 5 with Cognitive Science and Design with Alex Feiberg, great sessions. Everything from understanding the science behind how to design things to practical implementation tips so that you can take that vision and turn it into reality. So if you thought design wasn't important, you're wrong. This is your opportunity to rectify that and find out exactly how you can make sure that design is a central element to all of your app choices. So what else have we got? We've got sight. Now, sound is a little bit more subtle. How can we create an engaging app using sound? Isn't that a little bit specific? Well, it can be, but it doesn't have to be. Let's take text-to-speech. Again, this is pretty easy to set up. You need to check to see whether or not text-to-speech is installed on a device. If it isn't, then you need to start a new activity to install it, and if it is, you're ready to go. So it's a little bit of code which gets run once, and then to say something, it's a line of code. Now, this may seem like a small thing, but it's actually kind of a big deal. Now, whether it's an app like Google Navigation, which you simply can't use without text-to-speech, or something like Google Now, that creates that experience where you ask it a question and it tells you the answer. Now, you could just read it off the screen. There's no particular reason why it should read it out, but it does, and it speaks to us emotionally. We're interacting with it as we would a real thing or a real person, because that's what we prefer to do. We would prefer to interact with real objects and real people than machines or representations of things, and that's our challenge. And so using something like text-to-speech is that opportunity. And it adds functionality, functionality which, because it's sensory-based, is going to get people addicted to your app. Say I have two news apps, and they both look about the same, and they have the same quality of news. In fact, they're getting it from the same source. One of them maybe looks a little nicer, but the other one has the ability to read out my headlines to me as I'm driving to work in the morning. Now, suddenly I can only use one of those apps. And so by adding something like text-to-speech, you add a whole set of new users who previously wouldn't have had a reason to pick your app, but now suddenly it's the thing which makes your app different, which makes it stand out, which makes it an app they have to use. And they love you for it, because they feel like you've built that in just for them. You've built this so that I can use the app in my particular circumstances. That's the way you create these magical experiences, by developing for everyone and taking advantage of these simple things to create that rich sensory experience. But that's only half of the equation. If your apps can talk to you, then they should listen as well. And that's where speech recognition comes in. So here we're using intents with extras to specify our parameters. We're saying the language model we want, which is almost always going to be free form if you're just taking in data that you want to process, the prompt that you want to show the user, and the language you want to listen in. And then we start an activity which puts up the voice recognition dialogue and allows the user to start speaking. And we get all of that back on Activity Result Handler. Now, in this example, we're going to just take the most likely result off the top of the stack. We actually get back an array list of all the possible solutions based on the recognition algorithms. Now, the system just has to guess, well, which of these things most closely matches our expectations? But you have an opportunity. Because you know the context, you know what it was that prompted the user to say something to the device. So it's a much better idea to go through that entire list and say, well, based on what we're expecting, which of those things is the most likely response? And again, you can do something pretty special here. You can create an app that has better speech recognition ability than the platform, than Google Now. Because you know what to expect. You know exactly what you think the user was going to say. And so you're able to then go through this list and pick out the appropriate information. So what other senses do we have? I think I'd like to move on to touch. And I think touch is probably one of the most fundamental things about modern smartphones, is things which really changed over from the feature phones that we had in the past to something which was felt a little bit more magical, a little bit more futuristic. And so the first thing you need to do is make sure that the things which you have on screen are actually touchable. And that means corresponding to a 48-dip rhythm. Because 48 dips corresponds to about 9 millimeters of physical space, which, not coincidentally, is about the amount of space you need to touch something on a screen with your finger. And this is important, because you want to make sure that users actually get to press the things that they meant to press. You want to delight them. You don't want to antagonize them. If someone presses the screen, tries to do something, and something else happens, either they're going to get angry at your app because it did the wrong thing, or they're going to get angry at themselves because they did the wrong thing. Either way, you did the wrong thing. You want to create something delightful, something which makes people want to continue using your application. And that means you need to eliminate all of those situations where something happens which the user wasn't expecting. And it's one of the reasons why we suggest you not put buttons or any touch target towards the bottom of your screen, because they're so close to the navigation buttons, it's very easy to accidentally exit your app, which hopefully is exactly not what your users were expecting to happen. It's all really part of trying to create a more tactile experience, something which more closely resembles touching real things in the real world. And a big part of that is making sure that you understand that your users know what can be touched, and if they touch it, it should respond. If you touch a real thing in real life, you know you've touched it. It reacts somehow, even if it's just by pushing back against your finger. And so in this example, we're going to look at being able to create different backgrounds to take account of all of these different states of being touchable, of being touched, of being focused. Now, creating all of these different backgrounds seems like a lot of hard work. It is. So you can cheat and just use one we've built for you already. So you can either stick that in the background of things like buttons, or you can go the other way and stick it in the foreground. So if you've got something like an image view that you want to make touchable, you put this on the foreground, and that'll make sure that you have that same tactile response, that ability to touch things and see them react to you when you're touching them. So we talked earlier about creating apps which work for everyone, and we're talking about touch. We're talking about voice, so it seems reasonable to segue into making sure that your apps work really well for accessibility, for people who have visual impairments, to make sure that they too can take advantage of your beautifully designed app. And it's actually pretty easy. Again, add a content description to every control. And it's important here that you describe the content, not the container. So saying this is a button is not helpful. You have to say what the button does. So send message, add a contact, whatever it is. You need to remember that whoever is using this can't see your app, or at least can't see it well. So you want to keep it short, concise, and descriptive. And it's particularly important if you're building your own controls. So in this, we have a compass rose. And it's beautifully designed, and it shows exactly what your direction is. But for someone who can't see it, that's suddenly a disadvantage. So we're going to create our own accessibility event that describes that content. Every time the visual elements change, we're going to modify the output for accessibility support as well. Now, to take a step back, if we're talking about creating something more tactile, well, the real world you can interact with using more than just one finger pressing touch targets on a screen. You can use gestures. You can swipe things away. You can turn them around. You can move them all with your hands. And so I recommend checking out this Android training class on touch gestures. And this gives you an idea of some of the ways you can get started to create these more tactile, these more realistic interactions with the objects on the screen. But it's only really going part of the way because, again, we can do more than just interact with things with two fingers. We have 10. And, in fact, Android supports that with the delightfully named Jazz Hands. I voted for Spirit Fingers, but what are you going to do? In this example, we're keeping track of everything which is touching the screen. I'm going to go ahead and assume it's fingers. We know when things get pressed, we know when it gets lifted off, and we know every time something moves. And in fact, every event we receive has all of that information. So suddenly we have access to not just the location of every finger on the screen, but the relative movement over time, which means that we're able to create some fairly complex gestures. Now, I'm not suggesting you go and redesign your entire UI based on 10-finger chord progressions. It's going to make it a little less intuitive. But what an Easter egg. The first time someone picks up a CAD package and they go, well, I need this cog and this cog to move together and integrate. And to be able to do that, to resize, move, and shift, all using two hands on a single device, or having two people be able to play a game against each other on a large tablet. It's not quite Iron Man 3. It's not quite Minority Report. It's not that far off either. It certainly makes using a mouse and a keyboard look a lot like a hammer and a chisel. Once you've experienced this kind of user interaction, everything else is going to seem old and backwards. So you want to create that. You want to be the app which presents these magical experiences, these opportunities to see into what the future of user interaction is going to be like. Now, again, there are risks. We're breaking the rules. We're trying to create an emotional response from our users. And the reality is not every emotional response is positive. Particularly if you change things which people have gotten used to, things which people think as the killer feature of your app, and then you go and change it, or you make it unavailable because, well, you kind of got bored with it or it was hard to implement, they're going to react angrily. So it's really important that whenever you're trying to break those rules, break those conventions, that you do a lot of testing, which is why it's so helpful that Google Play now has the ability to do beta testing and staged rollouts, which means you can create a circle of people, your trusted testers, who you're going to push out these new releases for. So these are going to be your most passionate users. And you can test all of your changes, see how they react. You can use things like analytics to find out exactly how that's going, but better still, you should ask them. Because a lot of this emotional stuff, a lot of this engagement, is about more than just how people use the app. It's about how they feel about the app. So this now gives you that opportunity to talk to your users, give them a special version, and see how that goes before you start rolling it out. And once you do start rolling it out, you can keep track of how that's going. If you see that your star rating is starting to crash as you increase the number of people using the new version, it may be a good time to stop, take stock, and see whether or not you're making the right decision. And it's important to remember, too, when you're doing these things, that not all users are created equal. Now, they're certainly all equal in the general sense, but they're not all equally valuable to you. I had a look at the analytics for my app, Earthquake, on Google Play, and unsurprisingly, it turns out that smartphones are my largest audience. What was a little more surprising to me is that tablet users were far more engaged. They spent a lot more time in my app. Now, that may not be particularly relevant to you. Maybe you don't care how much time people spend in your app. If you're selling advertising, you probably do. If you're doing some other kind of monetization strategy, such as in-app billing, what's more important to you is understanding how quickly they navigate through that funnel. But either way, what you need to figure out is who is your most valuable user base? Who are the people which represent your key audience? What is making them happy? How do I make them happier? How do I make other people as happy as them? You can get a lot of this information from the Google Play Developer Console, which gives you a good start for understanding sort of the broad breakdowns of, you know, countries and devices and device types. But if you really want to understand that funnel, understand how people are going through your app, where they're exiting and why, you need to use a slightly more robust solution. And that's where something like Google Analytics for mobile applications comes into play. So here you can track every action, every button they press, every screen they swipe, to understand how they're using their app. What is their path? What is the path for people who are monetizing the best? How do I optimize that? Where are people exiting my app and why? And this kind of rich information is really important to understand how to create that delightful response, how to create something that speaks viscerally to your app so that it appears magical. You want to remove all the obstacles and make it as easy for them to enjoy your app as they can. That brings me to my final point. So a good magician never reveals his tricks. And neither should you, because that's the surest way of ruining the magic. You want to make people guessing, asking the question, how did they do that? Is that even possible? I didn't think you could do that. Telling them how totally destroys all of that. And for me, one of the most magical things about smartphones is still the internet, the fact that there is this cloud of information that has the answers to all of my questions. But you want to steal that magic for yourself. You don't want people thinking about the fact that your app is a portal to a world of information. You want people to think your app knows everything. And so a big part of that for me is to eliminate that transport mechanism, make people not think about the fact that this is happening. Or to put it another way, eliminate the refresh button. Or at least make it something that your users never have to press, something you can safely hide away in an overflow menu somewhere, and when you look at your analytics, it turns out actually no one uses it. Some people feel better that it's there, but they never have to, because your data is always up to date. It's always relevant. It's always low latency. You always know exactly what the user wants before they've even had to ask for it, and certainly before they've had to press refresh to find out where it is. Now, last year I talked a lot about this and the big cookie model for transferring data. So this idea of bundling and batching and prefetching all of your information to make sure that it's as efficient as possible when you're performing your data transfers. Now, this year I want to take a step sideways and look at some of the APIs that you can use to really implement some of those higher level notions. So generally speaking, amongst the reasons to transfer data are client updates, server updates, there's on-demand downloads and uploads, and cross-device updates. Now, for server updates, hopefully you're all very familiar with Google Cloud Messaging. You're using this instead of setting up repeating alarms to poll your server at a certain interval to find out if there's anything new to check, because it's clearly the right way to go. You use our infrastructure to have your server tell our server when the clients need to be updated, and then we can handle sending that information to your clients so that they don't need to poll. They just get notified of when there is new information that they need to synchronize with. Now, as I say, hopefully you're all already using this, because every time you set up a repeating alarm to poll a server to look for data updates, Sundar kills a bug droid. Sad but true. So moving on, let's have a look. What else can we do? Well, cross-device updates, that's another one, which is very handy. And as it turns out, Google Cloud Messaging can help you there as well. So now you can create a persistent XMPP connection between your server and our server and have your application running on the device send messages back to our server using the same Google Cloud Messaging infrastructure, rather than having to maintain that connection between your device and your servers yourselves. This is really useful. In fact, you can use this additionally to send messages from your device to other devices. So things like the Google Calendar notification cross-device dismissal that you saw at the keynote are all powered using this technology. So if a user gets notified on one device and they dismiss it, you want to be able to make sure that that same notification disappears on any other app that they're running, or sorry, on any other device that they're running, so they don't pick up their tablet and have 15 different notifications, which they've already dealt with on their phone. As it turns out, it's actually a pretty simple API. Certainly from the client side, all you need to do is get access to a Google Cloud Messaging object and send a message. And you can specify either a project ID to send it back to your server or a notification ID to transmit it to all of the other devices. I'm not going to go into too much detail. I'm not going to talk about the server setup because I am not a server guy. But Francesco, who is and knows all about Google Cloud Messaging because he wrote it, is presenting in this room at 1:40 this afternoon. So I recommend that you check it out. Even if you use Google Cloud Messaging, find out all about these new features and how you can make your apps even more efficient when it comes to downloading data. So GCM has taken care of server and cross-device. Let's have a look at client updates. Now, for client updates, when you've got information on your device that you want to send to a server, there's actually a really useful API that already exists if it's somewhat underutilized, and that is Sync Adapter. Now, one of the reasons it's not well utilized is because we've done a terrible job of documenting it, and we're going to change that. But I'm going to step you through the process now so you understand exactly how relatively simple it is. Now, I said there was going to be code. It's quite a lot of code here, quite a short amount of time, so be prepared. So you start by extending the abstract threaded Sync Adapter. This part is really simple. Extend it, override on perform sync, and this is all going to be done asynchronously and handled for you. So all of the queuing, all of the time shifting to make sure that all of your requests are bundled up together within sort of a short time window, and across apps as well, is all handled. We'll even check to see whether or not the device is connected to the internet and wait until you are until that happens. We can even support things like whether or not you're connected to Wi-Fi. So all of those intent receivers that I talked about last year, if you use the sync adapter, we will do all of that work on your behalf. Now, we designed all of this to work specifically to synchronize content providers associated with an account with a server where that data is stored. So think something like Gmail. So there's a little bit of extra plumbing that you need to do if you don't already have those. If you do have an account and a content provider in your app, good news, you can stop paying attention. For the rest of you, I'm going to show you a little shortcut so that you can take advantage of this API without having to figure out too much about the rest of it. So you start by wrapping your adapter in a service. And so this is going to represent the process that's actually going to run and execute that sync adapter when we request syncs. So far, so good. Next, we need to create an abstract account authenticator. And here's where it starts to look a little bit more complicated. But again, this is largely boilerplate stubbed code. The important thing here to keep in mind is the account type. So that is one of the things we're going to use to, as a key when we request syncs. It's going to be the account type and the content provider authority. All that's happening in this piece of code here is that we're going to basically create a dummy account. We're going to force a new account specifically for your application into the device. It's going to be invisible to users. It's not going to have authority to do anything. It's just a way of being able to create this dummy account that we can reference. Because it's doing something, we need to wrap that in a service as well. So that's going to be the service which wraps around that account adapter and creates it for you. And then we have a little config file where we define what our account type is again so that the manifest knows what it is when we're looking for an account that we can use, and a bunch of extra metadata which we don't actually need because we're not actually going to display this to anyone. So next we have a content provider, and I think this is probably a little bit more familiar to everyone. And this is just completely stubbed out. So even if you don't want to use a content provider in your app, you can still utilize this. The key here is, again, when we add it to our manifest. We define the authority, and that's the other key that we're going to use when we're asking for our syncs. So now we have all the information that we need to create our sync adapter XML. So if you already have an account type and a content provider, here's a bit where you get to start listening again. You specify the authority and the account type here so that when we're going through the manifest looking for a sync adapter that we want to run, those keys are available. Then we put all of it into the manifest, the services, the metadata associated with each of them, and we're ready to go. So now we get back to the easy bit. Once we want to request a sync, we simply specify the account and the content provider that we want to sync against, access the content resolver, request a sync, and that's it. It'll do all of the hard work for you. It'll figure out when it should initiate that synchronization. It'll handle being offline and online. All of those things will be done for you. And you can use this as well to do periodic syncs. By default, it's going to sync every 24 hours. So you can have it more often than that if that's appropriate for your app. Now, there's a few good reasons for doing this, but if we're talking about periodic synchronization, I feel like it would be remiss of me again not to mention one of the reasons why it's important not to try and sync your application at a specific time. Because there's that temptation. You know when your server is going to update 2 a.m. every morning, so why not just set an alarm so that we wake the device and perform that sync at exactly that time? Well, if you do that, your server traffic is going to look like this. That's fine, right? You don't care. You're in the cloud. You've got bandwidth. It's fine. Of course, everyone else's app, who is also running on the same device and waiting for the device to wake up before they do a synchronization, well, their server traffic is going to look like this too. That sucks to be them. They should have scaled. You did. They should be able to handle it as well. But what happens when you get your traffic and all the traffic from every other app on every device where your app is installed and add them all together? Well, then the carrier has a spike that looks like this. And that makes them very sad. This is a bad thing. This is what makes people's pages go off at exactly 2 a.m. every morning. So you want to make sure that you don't synchronize anything based on time. So if we're creating something like the synchronized sync adapter, which we just talked about, that's going to happen 24 hours from wherever your app was installed. So it's kind of pseudo-random. If you do want to manually create something around a specific time because that just makes sense, Even if you're not looking to transfer data, even if you just want to wake the phone up at 2 a.m. every morning to do something else, not related to the internet, you'll still have that follow-on effect to all of the other apps. So you want to create a bit of randomized jitter, something to spread that out across an hour or two, whatever you can handle, the wider the better, to try and spread that load, both for your servers, the servers of everyone else, not to mention the carrier bandwidth. Another approach you can take is to be a little bit cleverer and use sort of completely randomized information. So maybe it's you know what time the person gets up every morning, so you schedule it to happen between an hour and 2 hours before they get up. Or maybe you can use the activity recognition and say, look, I don't care until they pick their phone up first thing in the morning, then I want to perform the synchronization straight away. So we can use this API to find out when that happens and perform our syncs accordingly. What does that leave us with? On-demand downloads. Well, there's not a lot we can do there. On-demand downloads need to happen on demand. But we can be a little bit clever. We can build all of that into our sync adapter so that we can bundle and batch everything together. So every time we're doing a download because it has to happen, we request that sync and it'll happen within 30 seconds. We're going to upload everything we need to. We're going to prefetch everything we need to. We're going to transmit our analytics. We're going to download any ads. We're going to do our next prefetch ahead of time. All of that is going to happen whenever we do any kind of download. So we're batching that all, create a much more efficient app. All right, you've all been very patient. It's been a full hour. We started this session talking about how to create magical apps. And we're trying to do that in a world where time moves exponentially, or at least progress does. So that becomes a real challenge. Because we're trying to create apps that are so advanced that they seem as though they are magic. Something which if you showed the teenage version of yourself, they'd be left speechless. How does that work? Is that even possible? And in fact, that's really what we're trying to do, is create something that is impossible, something that seems impossible to everyone else. So hopefully, from today's session, you come away knowing how to use context to create these delightful experiences that are visceral, that speak to us on an emotional level. And of course, being good magicians, never giving away our tricks. So I'm hoping that when you leave this session today, you're not just developing new apps for the future, you're helping to define the future itself. Thank you.